Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 2016-2017 President of the Society of Nutrition, Education, and Behavior, Dr. Mary Mulramey.
Thank you so much. And with this, we are just about to open the next practice 2016 SNEB Conference. As we all know, for members of this conference, we have grown in every direction. We've grown in diversity, and we've grown in countries that we are working with. And today, before we go to the greatest, to great exhibitions, and before we start this conference, we want to do a small fraction of exhibition of the countries that SNEB have touched. The people that are walking are from different countries, and they will exhibit their beauty and their diversity. We are also looking at some of the countries that have their food guide pyramid and others that don't have, and mark to tell us that our work is not done till every country can have a guide of the way to feed its people. But meanwhile, we want to look at that diversity that expresses what SNEB is all about. Today, as even before we start, we have 20 countries that are represented in this conference. So ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to invite Sarah Theuri, who will guide the parade of the food guide pyramid.
I am so pleased to be able to participate in this food guide and SNEB diversity parade. And I'm sure you all know that food-based dietary guidelines are short, science-based, positive messages on eating healthy. And some countries have them and some don't. Do you know how many countries in the world already have food guides? We have more than 100 countries, okay? And these countries work with the Food and Agriculture Organization that assist them in the development, the revision, and the implementation of the food guide. So today we're gonna present to you two things. You're gonna see our own members who represent their countries displaying their national dress. We are also going to see the diversity of food guides that are out there. Countries have developed food guides and used symbols such as pyramids, pots, plates, or many other symbols that represents their food culture. So the Division of International Nutrition Education is so proud to present this to you, and we are going to start with North America, right? And as you see, let's see how do you advance here. Okay. So what you see highlighted in green are the countries of North America that already have food guides. And the stars represent the members that come from, that are represented in SNEB. So you're seeing two things. So 87% of countries in North America do have food guides. And we have about 28% of these countries represented in SNEB. So we'll start off with Canada. We do have membership, but I don't know anybody from Canada in the room? All right, there we go. Okay, very good. As you can see, Canada published their first food guide in 1942 and have been revising them. Okay. Costa Rica, is Costa Rica here? Okay, they, as you see, have a plate, and they published it back in 1997. Okay, Jamaica, is Jamaica in the house? No? They do have a plate. Mexico here, all right. Okay, very good. United States. There's United States. All right. All right, and as you see, United States has led the world in developing and revising food guides. Okay. Now, the rest of the food guides in within United States, we don't have the SNEB membership here. So what I'm going to do is just run through them in a slideshow. As you see this. All righty. Okay. Nathan, would you click on the little speaker? Just double click on it. No? It's supposed to move with the music, so. Bahamas has ghost skin drum, is what it is. Barbados uses the map of Barbados as their symbol. Food basket. To be a bird carrying a basket. That's a cutting board and a mortar. Be a sugar meal. That's a pot, a cold pot. That's a breadfruit. We're going to move to South America. Yeah, go ahead and switch. Okay, South America, 60%, 67% of these countries have food guides, and we do have only 8% of the SNEB representation. Now, together, I just put these together because Australia is represented by only two countries. As you can see, 14% SNEB and only 21% food guide. Colombia. Is Colombia here? Yes, Colombia. All right. And as you can see, Colombia is represented by a star. This is Australia. We have members from Australia. Anybody from Australia? No? Okay. So the rest of the countries here will run on a slideshow. It's right in the middle. Right next to the bottle. You see it? Thank you. That's a food spinning top. And now we move to Australia. Africa. Africa is next. As you can see, we have a lot of work to do in Africa, right? Okay. Only 11% of the countries have food guides. We do have several members, more members within the SNEB. So we have quite a few of our own representatives work out here. Is that everybody? Okay. So let's see. We do have Ethiopia. Is Ethiopia here? No? Kenya? Yes, Dr. Moremi. You want for Kenya? You're not Kenyan yet. That's all right. That's all right. Nigeria? All right. Nigeria has a food guide. We've got to learn from them. Malawi?
And when my baby was young, I carried it like this.
Oh, there you go. Thank you, Stacia.
It wasn't an itch, it was a girl.
Somalia. Yeah, there you go. So you have work to do, Habib. Habib, yeah, to help your country develop a food guide. Sudan. Sudan is not here. Okay. South Africa has food guide. Do we have South Africa here? No? All right. Rwanda. You have to go up again. Okay. Rwanda. Uganda. Zimbabwe. So all these are our member countries. Benin, we don't have anybody in SNEB from Benin, but they have developed their own food guide.
Oh, but Jenny is from Benin.
I did not know that. Where is she?
She's not here.
She's not here. Oh, okay. All right. We need to put a star on Benin then. Namibia. Namibia has a food guide. Seychelles. So those are the only countries in Africa that have a food guide. Okay, now we move on to Europe. Go ahead. Okay. As you can see, Europe has done quite some work in their food guides. But in our membership, we need to, I guess this is talk to the, what you call it, the membership committee. We have work to do, yeah, to pull them forward. Okay, France, that's France. Italy, we have a member from Italy. Anybody in the house from Italy? Malta, our own past president. All right, okay. Okay. Thank you. was supposed to be a house, healthy house, also healthy food. Switzerland has three different guides for different populations. Asia and the Middle East. Okay. Right. So you can see we have only 35% of these countries with a food guide, and our membership is only about 18% represented from there. Okay. All right. Okay, India. So you can see their pretty dresses. Very nice. Okay. Israel. Very nice. Yeah, she's wearing her flag. Japan. Wearing the kimono, yeah, very good, beautiful. Jordan, we don't have Jordan here, but we have a member from Jordan. They don't have a food guide, that's why you only see the flag. Kuwait, anybody from Kuwait? Lebanon, we have a member from Lebanon. Saudi Arabia. No. Pakistan. Beautiful. Awesome. Sri Lanka. There you go. South Korea. All right. Thank you. And then the rest will be slideshow. Thank you. Philippines has 4 population food guide. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of this show.
Wonderful. Once again, Diane introducing us to the world and for us to sit down here and see what has been done and all the innovations and thoughts. It's amazing. Thank you so much, Sarah. Today we am going to ask Anne to come up and introduce us our speaker, our opening session for the session, and I will ask you to come and introduce yourself and introduce us to the speaker.
Thank you. Good evening. It's my privilege to introduce to you Dr. Susan Main. Dr. Main is the director for the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. In this position, Dr. Main leads the center's development and implementation of programs and policies related to the composition, quality, safety, and labeling of foods, food and color additives, and cosmetics. An internationally recognized public health leader and scientist, Dr. Main received her BA in chemistry from the University of Colorado. She earned a PhD in nutritional science and with minors in biochemistry and toxicology from Cornell University. Dr. Main came to the FDA from Yale University, where she was the CEA Winslow Professor of Epidemiology. Her distinguished career there includes 2 leadership positions: the chair of the Department of Chronic Disease Epidemiology and the associate director of the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Main has conducted extensive research into the complex role of food, nutrition, and other health behaviors as determinants of chronic disease. She is the author or co-author of more than 200 scientific publications. Dr. Main completed 2 consecutive terms on the Food and Nutrition Board of the National Academy of Sciences, and a 5-year term on the board of the scientific counselors for the National Cancer Institute. And she also served on the Nutrition Advisory Committee for the FDA. And she's worked closely with many other government agencies, including the U.S. Department of Agriculture, on developing practical applications of research. Dr. Main regrets that she cannot be here this evening at the conference, but we hope that you enjoy her video presentation on the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's role in improving nutrition, labeling, and other authorities. So thank you.
Thank you. I'd first like to thank SNNB for inviting me to participate in your annual conference. My apologies for not being able to be there in person with all of you here today. I will acknowledge that some of my colleagues from FDA are in there in person. So again, I hope you have a wonderful conference. I'm sorry I cannot be there to attend with you. But what I will do today is share with you some of what FDA is doing to improve nutrition in the United States. By way of background, many people are unfamiliar with FDA's responsibilities, so a few facts that you might find interesting relevant to our work in nutrition. 25 cents out of every consumer dollar that is spent in the United States is on FDA-regulated products. We regulate the safety and the labeling of 80% of all food consumed in the United States, with most of the remainder coming from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Our job is to ensure that consumers are provided with accurate and useful information in food labeling. We also encourage food product reformulation to create healthier products. We work in close collaboration with many of our other federal partners, CDC, NIH, USDA, to name a few, in our work on nutrition. By way of background, CIFSEN has responsibilities for food safety as well as nutrition, and the two are mutually reliant. And I would say that health really lies at the intersection of nutrition and food safety. And the reason for that is that many of the foods that we recommend that Americans consume more of, things like fruits and vegetables, are also some of the food items that we have concerns about from a food safety point of view. And that's because commodities like fruits and vegetables are often consumed raw. And so if there is any bacterial contamination, there's no what we call a kill step to make sure that those foods stay safe. So in order to have consumers follow the dietary guidelines, food safety is a really important aspect of that. And again, the center that I lead, the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, is really at the intersection of food safety and nutrition. So we work in many different ways. We work in terms of inspection and compliance on the food safety side. We also have a very robust regulatory science research program that's really working very hard to prevent food safety outbreaks and to solve outbreaks earlier using state-of-the-art science. But now, today, we're going to focus primarily on nutrition and not on the food safety side of the work that's done at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. And in the work that we do in nutrition, one of our goals is to reduce the rates of nutrition-related risk factors for chronic disease. And so an example of some of the work that we have been highlighting that I want to share with you today is the work we've done on trans fats in relationship to coronary heart disease. By way of background, science has shown for many years that trans fats are adverse for health by raising the risk of cardiovascular disease. We have robust data from controlled feeding trials, robust data from prospective cohort studies, consistent results highlighting that trans fats are adverse for health. This was followed by several consensus reports from various scientific organizations highlighting the problem of trans fats in the food supply with regard to cardiovascular disease risk. So what did FDA do with that science? Well, we've been working on that problem for several years. First, in 1999, FDA proposed labeling efforts with regard to trans fats. The labeling final rule was published in 2003, and as I'm sure you are all aware, trans fats were added as a line on the Nutrition Facts label in 2006, using our labeling authorities to inform consumers about the trans fat content in the foods that they were purchasing. In response to providing that information to consumers, trans fat intake in the United States declined almost 80%. And that's due to two things. That's due to food companies reformulating their products to reduce the amount of trans fat in those products. It's also due to the fact that consumers were choosing products that had lower levels of trans fat. So that was an important public health gain in reducing the exposure to trans fat. However, about 20% of that trans fat exposure was persisting in the food supply. And so what FDA did then is basically issued a notice that we did not believe that trans fats any longer met the GRAS designation or generally recognized as safe. So FDA published our tentative determination with that conclusion. We went through notice and comment period and finally published our final determination last year in 2015 that trans fats, these artificially produced, partially hydrogenated oils, no longer met the GRAS designation or generally recognized as safe. Their compliance time for this was 3 years, so as of June of 2018, artificially produced trans fats are no longer allowed in the food supply unless companies come into the FDA through a food additive petition process to indicate any low-level exposures that they could demonstrate to FDA would be safe. So this is important work that FDA has done to try to reduce cardiovascular disease risk. To highlight the importance of the work, the American Public Health Association identified FDA removing artificial trans fat from the nation's food supply as one of the top 10 most important public health stories from 2015. Moving on, another aspect that we do to affect nutrition in this country is really look at our labeling authorities. And we have a job to make sure that consumers have access to accurate and useful information so that they can make healthy food choices. As I'm sure you are all aware, we have updated the Nutrition Facts label and released the updated Nutrition Facts label quite recently at the end of May of 2016. This is the first major update to the Nutrition Facts label in approximately 20 years. So it was time for an update to the Nutrition Facts label. And what I will echo is that the Nutrition Facts label has stood the test of time, but the changes that we are making and will be making moving forward with the Nutrition Facts label reflect the emerging science and the science that has been changing over the last several years. So the process we went through is as follows. We issued proposed rules in March of 2014. We had a supplemental proposed rule issued in 2015, and two final rules, again, published at the end of May in 2016. The first one is on the Nutrition Facts label itself. The second one was updating serving size requirements. And the serving size requirements rule basically says what the current serving sizes are that Americans are consuming. We are required by statute to make sure that the serving sizes that are reflected on Nutrition Facts label reflect what Americans are actually consuming. So these two rules were published simultaneously at the end of May in 2016. In terms of compliance, most manufacturers have approximately 2 years to comply with the Nutrition Facts labeling update. But businesses that are smaller, that is, have less than $10 million in annual revenue, have an extra year to come into compliance. So over the next 2 to 3 years, consumers will be seeing the updated Nutrition Facts label that was rolled out in May of 2016. So what are some of the key changes made to the Nutrition Facts label? I'd like to highlight some of the big changes that we've made. One of the most important changes is that we have now mandated the declaration of added sugars. So added sugars is a new element on the Nutrition Facts label with the updated format. And in addition to having added sugars, there's also a percent daily value. And the percent daily value is based upon 10% of calorie intake coming from added sugars. We've also modernized the format to give much greater prominence to things like calories as well as serving size information. We've also updated the footnote to highlight the succinct statement about 2,000 calories being the basis of a normal, typical diet. We updated daily values that needed updating. There have been many updated dietary reference intakes since the original Nutrition Facts labels were produced, so we updated the daily values for several of the nutrients in order to reflect the most current science. We also updated the nutrients of public health significance. These are nutrients that are required to be declared on the Nutrition Facts label. Two new ones that will now be showing up on food labels, Nutrition Facts labels, are vitamin D and potassium. They are taking the place of vitamins A and vitamin C, which are no longer considered public health nutrients of great significance. In terms of trans fat will remain on the Nutrition Facts label because there are natural sources of trans fat. And also we are in this transition period while we are phasing out the artificial sources of trans fat. So trans fat will remain on the Nutrition Facts label. We've also made some key changes with regard to dietary fiber. Now, in order for a fiber to be included on a Nutrition Facts label, there has to be evidence reviewed by FDA that any added fibers have physiological benefit to human health. So that's an important change in terms of the types of fibers that can now be declared on the Nutrition Facts label. There are record-keeping requirements for the first time for companies to keep so that we can validate the information that goes onto the Nutrition Facts labels. As indicated before, we have been updating the serving sizes, so the reference amounts customarily consumed, or RACs, have been updated for several different products. For example, the standard serving size for a sugar-sweetened beverage type soda used to be 8 ounces. That has now been updated to 12 ounces to really reflect what consumers consume today. To give consumers more information about the calorie and nutrient content they're consuming in certain types of packages, we now require dual column labeling with nutrition information listed per serving and per package for certain types of products. For example, products that contain 2 to 3 servings per container. And also we've changed the criteria for single serving packages. So for example, again with soft drinks or soda, while 12 ounces is the reference amount customarily consumed, a 20-ounce soda would be required to declare the content for that entire package as one serving, because that is typically how it is consumed. So in a nutshell, those are some of the key changes that have been made with regard to the Nutrition Facts label to really make the information more accessible to consumers, to update the information to reflect current nutrition science, and as I indicated, to now add on added sugars as a new element on the nutrition facts label. During the transition to the new label, as I indicated, consumers are still seeing the existing nutrition facts label and will start seeing the new nutrition facts label over the next 2 to 3 years. It's basically up to the food manufacturers to roll them out as they reprint their labels. So we will start seeing those new labels in the near future. And during that transition, we are continuing our educational efforts to help consumers understand nutrition facts labels in general. So some of the tools that we have recently released to help with our educational efforts on nutrition facts labeling include one particular interactive nutrition facts label game that's targeted to children ages 8 to 15 to help them understand nutrition facts labeling. We have a couple of different games in this. This FDA Snack Shack and Wyville, two games for tweens. The first one is called Snack Shack. They're two different games that teach Wyville citizens how to understand the nutrition facts label. There's a module that includes label lingo to teach teens, tweens, information about the label. And there's also a module on snack sorting, which helps tweens rank and choose different types of foods based using the nutrition facts label for reference. And during the first 6 weeks after the launch of this nutrition education initiative, more than 8,000 games were played by tweens who are learning about use of the nutrition facts label. We've also developed an online tool, essentially an interactive label, that allows consumers to explore the different parts of the label, to focus in on the nutrients that they are specifically interested in. So I think that this is very helpful for consumers. They can go to the ingredient list, understand the different components of the ingredient list. There's also 16 downloadable and printable fact sheets about the different components of the label that we hope consumers will take advantage of in learning how to use the label format. And if you're interested in finding our website and finding the information on our website, you can simply search for Learn About the Nutrition Facts Label, and that will take you to all the different modules that we have available to help consumers understand the Nutrition Facts Label. Also, we're working with healthcare professionals to help communicate how to use the Nutrition Facts Label in educating their patients. So, for example, recently, in collaboration with the American Medical Association, we produced a video, a continuing CME education video for physicians about using the Nutrition Facts Label in terms of helping patients make healthful choices. This was launched in June of this year. And while physicians are knowledgeable about nutrition's role in health, they may be familiar with the nutrition facts label, but this really walks physicians through through examples right on the video of how to work with them on different label elements that may be helpful to their patients. So it's targeted for general health as well as to combat obesity, reducing the risk of other chronic illnesses such as cardiovascular disease. The video and the companion patient educational materials are all available for healthcare professionals on the FDA as well as the AMA website. And the FDA will be updating all of these educational resources that reference the nutrition facts label to reflect the transition to the new label, which was announced, as I said, just last month in May of 2016. And again, if you're interested in this, please search for food safety and nutrition resources for healthcare professionals, and you will find access to these, to the AMA video and other resources that are helpful in learning how to use the nutrition facts label. So now that the FDA has published the final rule updating the nutrition facts and supplement facts labels, as well as the serving size rule, we have some other work to do. And that is because many of our regulations, for example, nutrient content claims, will also need to be updated. For example, with changes in serving sizes, that could affect nutrient content claims. With changes in daily reference values, that could also affect nutrient content claims. So now that the nutrition facts label has been updated, we will be working to update the rest of the regulations so that they all work together and are consistent with each other with regards to nutrition facts labeling. So in addition to nutrition content claims, we also need to update some other label information. One example is the term healthy. We have received a citizen's petition, for example, from the Kind Company to update the term healthy. And we recognize healthy is one thing that we need to update to make sure that, again, all of the different labeling elements work together and are consistent. Another one that we need to update moving forward is the term natural. And we have issued a notice as well as a request for comments about the process of updating the term natural. And we asked a series of questions about how people interpret the term natural with regard to food labeling. We've asked questions about how a food is produced. Should that affect whether or not it could carry a natural label? How about ingredients that are produced through genetic engineering? Should they qualify for natural labeling or not? And we went through a public comment period. It was extended until May 10th of 2016, so the comment period on natural labeling closed fairly recently. To date, we received over 6,000 comments with regard to natural labeling. And the team will be sifting through the comments as we work to move forward with regard to the label term natural on a food label. And anything we do will, of course, be the result of a very public process. Now, some other labeling activities that FDA has been engaged in that are relevant to nutrition include our menu labeling and our vending machine labeling initiatives. Beginning with menu labeling, the Affordable Care Act stipulated that certain chain restaurants and similar retail food establishments must disclose nutrition information for standard menu items. And what that means is it means a disclosure of calories in standard menu items on menus and menu boards. It also means providing to consumers upon request other nutrition information that they might want to have made available. And it also says that along with menu labeling, there has to be the succinct statement about suggested calorie intake. So a consumer would know how many calories in a food, how that might relate to a total daily intake. The proposed rules were published in 2011. Final rules were published in December of 2014. A final guidance document came out in May of 2016. And now the compliance date is 1 year from that, or May 5th in 2017. So starting in May 5th of 2017, menus and menu boards need to include calorie content, calorie information for consumers. For menu labeling, the covered establishments include those that have a chain of 20 or more locations, and there's certain other criteria that are detailed in the rule. So this will be a big step forward for consumers in having access to calorie as well as nutrition information made available upon request to foods eaten in restaurant settings and in similar retail food establishments. With regard to vending machines, a similar stipulation came from the Affordable Care Act, and basically it said that for vending machine operators that have 20 or more vending machines, they must disclose calorie information at the point of purchase. And the compliance date for that is December 1st of 2016 for most vended items. So again, tools giving the consumer access to information that can help them choose healthier diets, in this case, at the point of purchase. All right, some of the other important nutrition activities that FDA has been engaged in. One that I want to highlight today is the work that we've been doing on sodium. On June 1st, FDA announced that we were issuing draft targets for industry that would provide voluntary reduction targets for industry across a whole array of different types of foods. Essentially, what the approach is what we published are short-term targets, that is 2-year targets, as well as long-term targets, or 10-year targets, once finalized that the industry should be trying to meet to help lower the amount of sodium in the U.S. food supply. The approach that we are taking is a gradual approach to reducing current sodium consumption. The short-term targets are designed to reduce sodium intake to around 3,000 milligrams per day from the current 3,400 milligrams per day. And the long-term targets are designed to reduce sodium intake to 2,300 milligrams per day. And these targets take longer because we recognize that there are some technical constraints on sodium reduction and reformulation that the food industry will need to work through. So the 10-year targets allow for that time for industry to achieve those particular targets. The approach that we've taken is we identified 16 major categories of foods, 150 subcategories of foods, and we looked across those food categories at the sodium content on foods that are selling in the marketplace across these different categories. And what we've realized is that there was quite a bit of variation across these different categories, and there are products selling on the market that were successful that had much lower sodium content. So progress can certainly be made in sodium reduction across these different categories. Now, a key aspect of the sodium targets is that it applies to food manufacturers, it applies to restaurants, and it also applies to food service operations. And the reason is that consumers eat a lot of food outside of the home, in the restaurant setting, in the retail setting, and we want to make sure that there is a level playing field across the food supply as we work to reduce the amount of sodium content in the food supply. We are now engaged in a public comment process with industry to figure out if these targets are correct, if they need any modifications. So we are engaged in a dialogue with industry, but the important thing is that it really gives industry a common metric that they can all compare themselves against with regard to sodium reduction initiatives. And we give credit to progress that had been made by industry over the last several years with regard to their sodium reduction initiatives. In fact, many of the top-selling products on the market today are already meeting the short-term targets. But we believe this is a very important path forward in order to really address the problem of sodium and excess sodium in the U.S. food supply. So a few comments on why I believe this is a very important initiative and why FDA has really focused on this. First of all, we eat too much sodium. As I mentioned, 3,400 milligrams. It leads to high blood pressure, which is a major risk factor for heart disease and stroke. And this is consistent with the evidence that's been reviewed by many different organizations, the Institute of Medicine, the most recent Dietary Guidelines for Americans, Healthy People 2020, all target sodium reduction as an important thing for public health in the U.S. The totality of the scientific evidence clearly supports reduction from the current levels of intake. And this, is based upon a lot of evidence, including clinical trials looking at sodium reduction and the effects on blood pressure. Also based upon high-quality cohort studies that link higher sodium intake with higher risk of cardiovascular disease events. If you'd like to look at that science in greater detail, I will refer you to a publication that was issued in the New England Journal of Medicine, as well as the Journal of American Medical Association, on the day that we released the sodium targets, and that was June 1st. One in particular was authored by Dr. Thomas Frieden, head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that really emphasizes the science supporting sodium reduction in the U.S. food supply. So why are the targets so important? Why did we choose this particular strategy? The main reason is that most of the sodium that we consume in our diets comes from salt that's added to processed and restaurant foods. Many consumers report that they're trying to reduce sodium, but salt that's added during cooking or salt that's added at the table comprises a relatively small proportion of daily sodium intake. About 3/4 of our daily intake comes from processed and prepared foods. That makes it really difficult for all of us to control how much sodium we consume. Even many of us who have a strong background in nutrition find it to be a great challenge. So while there has been initiative done by many industries, there hasn't been a level playing field. And so to get to a level playing field, we really need to lower it in these important contributors to sodium in the U.S. food supply. And so the targets are issued across a whole array of different types of foods, ranging from salad dressings to bread to prepared foods. And we encourage you to look at some of those targets that are on our website to see what types of reductions certainly should be possible. What are some of the other nutrition activities that have been ongoing at the FDA? One of the things that I wanted to highlight is that FDA is responsible for nutrient fortification of our food supply. In 1996, FDA authorized folic acid fortification in enriched cereal grain products for the purposes of reducing birth defects, specifically anencephaly and spina bifida. So we've had folic acid fortification of certain grains in the food supply for approximately 20 years now, with demonstrated improvements in public health, namely reductions in birth defects. And that's an important public health gain. More recently, FDA was approached by several organizations that wanted to extend folic acid fortification to one specific commodity, namely corn masa flour. And the concern was that many women of childbearing age who regularly consume products that are made from corn masa flour might not be getting the benefits of folic acid enrichment or fortification of the more traditional cereal grains. And therefore, they might be at a higher risk for neural tube defects. And specifically women who consume corn masa flour, this is widely consumed in women of Latin American descent. So this is a population that may be at higher risk because of their dietary practices. So we were approached with a food additive petition to add folic acid to corn masa flour. So FDA reviewed the food additive petition and in April of this year went ahead and approved that folic acid fortification to the same level in corn masa flour as what it currently exists in enriched flour. So when FDA reviews fortification, we have to do a safety determination, and the standard that we use is the reasonable certainty of no harm standard. And so what that means is in order to approve fortification, FDA has to really look at cumulative exposure to folic acid, considering all foods in which folic acid or any food additive can be used, and considering population groups that might be especially affected by the fortification policy. It does not consider the benefits. A food additive petition only looks at safety. So what FDA did is we modeled folic acid intake across 8 different age groups in the population, across both men and women, and considering different racial and ethnic groups in terms of their intake patterns. And we modeled the current data, looking at what folic acid intake is right now across all of these different subpopulations, as well as what would happen to the intake if corn masa flour were fortified with the levels that were being considered. And what the data indicated is that there would be a small increase in folic acid intake in the general population, approximately a 7% overall increase in folic acid. But in the target population of non-pregnant women aged 15 to 44 years, specifically focusing in on Mexican-American women, this would predict about a 26% increase in folic acid in this population that, again, consumes more of this particular type of flour. So that was the intake estimate. As part of the safety evaluation, we had to consider what possible adverse effects or safety concerns might this have for the general population. The primary concern with regard to folic acid fortification is masking of vitamin B12 deficiency, which is common in older people in our country. So FDA looked carefully at what were the primary risk factors for excess consumption of folic acid, where it was determined that it's really supplement use. People who take supplements, multivitamin, multimineral supplements, are at much greater risk of having high intakes of folic acid. Any additional risk from fortification of this particular flour was negligible. So in considering people who have these higher intakes due to supplements, the question is, are we confident in the safety? And the determination was yes, because first there was a large safety margin based upon a very conservative exposure assessment. And second of all, the health risk of vitamin B12 masking, noting that the biggest risk factor for excess folic acid is supplements. Those supplements typically would contain B12 along with folic acid. So based upon the safety evaluation that FDA did, we approved fortification of folic acid in corn masa flour. So a few of the other things we're doing on the nutrition front. We also evaluate risks associated with contaminants in our food supply. And one particular contaminant that we've been looking at recently is inorganic arsenic. So inorganic arsenic is present in water, soil, and air from natural sources, as well as a result of human activities. And for that reason, it makes its way into a variety of different foods. And one food in particular that we have been concerned about is rice. And that's because rice takes up more inorganic arsenic than most other foods. Inorganic arsenic is a known carcinogen. It increases risk of bladder and lung cancer, for example. And it's also been associated with many non-cancer effects in both acute and chronic setting. So why is the FDA being concerned about inorganic arsenic in rice? As I indicated, rice takes up more inorganic arsenic than other commodities. Rice is also an ingredient in a lot of different foods and beverages, and so that has generated worldwide interest in the issue of inorganic arsenic in rice. So Codex, the international standards, they have set a standard of 200 parts per billion inorganic arsenic as a limit for white rice. Now, with regard to other concerns about inorganic arsenic, one of the concerns is neurodevelopmental concerns resulting from early life exposure to inorganic arsenic. So FDA looked at this very carefully. We've done a lot of food analysis, sampling and analysis. We've done a risk assessment. We've talked about risk management, and then also how do we communicate those risks. So as part of one of our risk assessments, we looked at modeling rice intake, noting that rice has the highest levels of inorganic arsenic of most of the foods that we've tested. And we looked at what populations are specifically consuming the most rice. And what the data reveal is that the highest rice intake occurs actually in infants at 8 months of age. And it's approximately 3 times greater than adults, and that's based upon a per kilogram body weight basis. And there's 2 reasons why infants have had the highest intake of rice and also therefore inorganic arsenic. One is that infants have commonly been fed infant rice cereal as a first starter food, and they don't have the dietary variety that adults have. So on a per kilogram body weight basis, infants have the highest rice intake of all. So this flagged up infant rice cereal as an issue of concern for the FDA because of the amount of inorganic arsenic and because of the high consumption of rice in infants. So as a next step, FDA then looked at testing a lot of different foods that infants and toddlers may be consuming. Because if we wanted to focus in on infant rice cereal, we wanted to be sure that we knew what the inorganic arsenic levels would be in other foods that infants might be consuming. So we did a lot of testing and we released all of that test information publicly on our website. And what we found is that infant rice cereal is a much higher exposure to inorganic arsenic than essentially any of the other foods as a group that we were looking at in the infant and toddler setting. What we found is that other infant cereals that are not made from rice, for example, barley or whole grain cereals, had much lower levels of inorganic arsenic. So as a result of looking at all of the data and looking at this particular issue with a vulnerable population, FDA proposed a draft action level of 100 part per billion inorganic arsenic in infant rice cereal. And when we set an action level, we have to think about public health risk, and we can also look at feasibility. And the point here is that if we can reduce inorganic arsenic levels with an action level, that will reduce exposure in this vulnerable population. Working in collaboration with organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics, we've been giving advice to parents and caregivers. And what we've recommended is feeding infants iron-fortified cereals to be sure that the infant is getting enough of this important nutrient, but that it doesn't have to be rice cereal, that there are other infant cereals that can certainly be considered like oat cereal, barley, multigrain cereals. For toddlers, we recommend providing a well-balanced diet, which includes a variety of grains and not just focusing in specifically on rice. All right, a few more comments before we wrap up today. I mentioned that FDA is responsible for food labeling. And one area that I wanted to highlight is we are also responsible for labeling of foods that come from genetically engineered sources. As I'm sure you know, there has been much interest of late in the labeling of foods that contain ingredients derived from genetically engineered sources. There was a labeling bill passed in Vermont that went into effect July 1st that mandated the labeling of foods that contain ingredients that are derived from genetic engineering. There are numerous bills that have been debated in Congress and the Senate, and just recently, the Senate has passed legislation that is now going to move to the House that would mandate labeling of foods that contain genetically engineered ingredients. And so this legislation is making its way through, and the point from an FDA perspective is that FDA will, of course, carry out any labeling requirements that come to us through any legislation, so we will be closely engaged with the movement forward nationally with regard to the labeling of genetically engineered foods. In the meantime, FDA has issued guidance documents. We've given food manufacturers information on how they can label their foods. For example, if their foods contain ingredients from GE crops, what that labeling would look like. We also published guidance on how to label genetically engineered salmon. And we also know that many food companies over the last several months are now voluntarily labeling genetically engineered ingredients. So FDA is working on a path forward to develop consumer education materials about what this labeling might look like and how consumers can begin to understand the labeling of genetically engineered foods. So in summary, I just wanted to highlight the fact that FDA really does an enormous amount to improve nutrition in the United States. I've highlighted some of our most important recent actions that are truly very high impact in the U.S. in terms of their role in improving the nutritional status of the U.S. population. For example, the work we've done on partially hydrogenated oils, the work we are doing to reduce sodium intake in the U.S. food supply, and our changes with regard to labeling, for example, putting added sugars on the label for the very first time. I would argue that these are very, very important changes that have occurred under this particular administration and can really go a long way towards improving the nutrition status of the United States population. So thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions that people may have by email after this point. Thank you.
Wow, what a good presentation. Lots of information. And please, on behalf of the planning committee and the board of directors of Society for Nutrition, Education and Behavior, please take our gratitude to Dr. Susan Main for doing this piece. We knew that she had problems, that family issues that she couldn't come, but taking that time to highlight that information is highly appreciated. Once again, thank you. Well, I think it's time for us to open and to walk through our SNEB 2016 Next Practice. We have amazing exhibition waiting to give us a chance to taste, to touch, and to see the next practice resources after this. But do not miss to hear Dr. Christine Economos, our keynote speaker, tomorrow at 8 o'clock. Major debate on weight issues and a movie night all are in store for you in this conference. Check the breakout sessions, take away practice points, but remember the Briggs and the BMAC symposiums. Do not be in a hurry to go home. We have great post-conference plans and tours, and we will have a summary of all that we have done. The next slide. I want to highlight you who is here. We are almost breaking to 800. This number was about 3 days ago, so we don't know with a walk-in how many people have registered, but we have a total of 733. We've broken many records. But that's not all. SNEB is interested with the next generation, and 11% of the attendees, or 80 by number, are students. We have 48 states represented. We are missing Alaska and Wyoming. We will look for you. But the greatest joy is to know we have 20 countries represented in this conference. The beauty of that pie chart, as I put it together, is to look at the new members. We have 19% are new members. I know there is a trick. Sometimes when we have a conference, we do make it easy for you to join new membership. But don't give it up yet. 50th anniversary is in Washington next year. You want the same. You want to go as a member. So please don't drop your membership. We have 34%. Non-members. What this is telling us is that Society for Nutrition Education is relevant to both members and non-members. And non-members, you are so welcome, but we also welcome you to be members. Almost half of the attendees are members, seeing that that is a great commitment for our members. And so with that, I will release you for the next practice, 2016, and Sarah and the group is going to lead us to the exhibitions. Thank you.
I'm on top of the world.